Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of June 11th, 2019. We traveled to the Greenville News to speak with reporters about the paper's recent project on South Carolina prisons, which looked at disciplinary action taken against hundreds of corrections officers and other factors surrounding that riot that took place at Lee Correctional Institution more than a year ago. The investigation into the incident, which left 7 inmates dead and 22 injured, remains ongoing, and no one has been charged yet. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who are at the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all 4 sections of our podcast instead of wondering about how South Carolina's favorite beer is PBR. Okay, interesting. Or wondering who will tweet about some personal news next in your Twitter feed. Isn't that what LinkedIn's for? Or Facebook? Just, please, no more personal news. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the Post and Courier reports that a South Carolina lesbian couple is suing the Trump administration and Governor Henry McMaster for discrimination after they were denied service by Miracle Hill Ministries, a government-funded Christian foster care agency. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services granted McMaster's waiver in January, allowing faith-based foster care agencies to deny services on religious grounds. McMaster says the waiver is meant to protect Miracle Hill's religious freedom. The couple says the policy is exclusionary. Number two, former Fifth Circuit Solicitor Dan Johnson has been sentenced to 1 year and 1 day in federal prison on charges of fraud with misuse of office credit cards. The state newspaper reports Johnson stole more than $44,000 over 2 years. The Public Access to Public Records, a foundation created by current State Senator Dick Harpulian, exposed Johnson's excessive spending last year. Johnson was suspended from the solicitor post last fall after being indicted, and he lost the Democratic primary to Brian Gibson. Number three, the Post and Courier reports that the state's Joint Bond Review Committee has agreed to authorize $12 million in spending on securing permits to extend Interstate 526 around Charleston. The project would extend the interstate across Johns Island and James Island. The committee will review the project again when there is an updated cost estimate for the 7-mile extension. The I-526 extension project has often been delayed and has been revived this year because Charleston County agreed to cap the state's cost at $420 million and to use county money to pay for the rest of the extension. And number four, the Post and Courier reports that the South Carolina Department of Health and Environmental Control is reviewing a Texas company's permit for seismic blast testing off the coast. Western GECO wants to test from Virginia to Georgia to map underwater oil and gas reserves. The company is one of 6 companies seeking federal permits for offshore testing, but Western GECO is the only one currently up for review by the state. Governor McMaster, South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson, and Representative Joe Cunningham all oppose offshore testing and exploration. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week we give you just a headline, a little taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. This week, Florida man pours salt on floor of Walmart to get rid of evil spirits around him. I do that at work all the time. And just like all that some personal news that I hide on my Twitter feed, oh yeah, I am not letting go of this. We buried the lead. Several inmates wielding knives and shivs roamed 3 housing units at Lee Correctional Institution on April 15, 2018. Only 6 unarmed corrections officers were on duty in those housing units while a gang turf war exploded in the Bishopville facility. Outnumbered, the officers waited some 7 hours until reinforcements arrived and fully contained the uprising. During that time, 7 inmates were killed and 22 were wounded. Since then, some 41 inmates have been investigated and 29 appear to remain under investigation, but none have been charged yet. The riot prompted a team of Greenville News and Anderson Independent Mail reporters to send Freedom of Information Act requests to the Department of Corrections, looking at aspects of the riot, the difficulty of hiring and retaining corrections officers, and what the current state of the agency is. Nikki Mayo and Kirk Brown of the Anderson Independent Mail and the Greenville News recently reported on these issues and join me now to discuss their findings. Welcome to the South Carolina Lead.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Good to be up in the that Greenville. So like I mentioned that you guys were interested in this because of that riot. Tell me, what were some of the biggest issues you found from those Freedom of Information Act requests you got there, Nikki?
Well, I think that we were looking to try to see what we could figure out about not just what happened at Lee, but sort of the entire system. As we looked at the data, we found problems with turnover in correctional officers. We found discipline problems among correctional officers, some 30% who were disciplined during a 16-month period for which we sought records. We found, you know, several gaps in the system, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, what we did after leaves, we filed a couple of Freedom of Information requests, one dealing with correctional officers and the other dealing with disciplinary actions against inmates. And it took us almost a year before the information came back to us. We found that 400 officers were disciplined in a 16-month period from January of 2017 to April of 2018. We found 104 of them were fired and that 19 were criminally charged with everything from bringing cell phones and contraband into prisons to sexual misconduct with inmates.
Mm-hmm. And so you guys published a story about how the Lee correctional officers also received more lenient disciplinary actions against them for issues that arose on the job leading up to the riot. And you compare that to other prisons too. What did you find out about that? And what was some of the reasoning why those correctional officers of that prison maybe received more lenient disciplinary actions?
We were comparing maximum security prisons first, and we found that as we were looking at incidents of officer negligence, that's actually how they were referred to as incidents of officer negligence in the records, and we found that at Broad River Correctional Institution in Columbia, for example, if an officer was found to be negligent during this period, this 16-month period where we had records, there were 10 instances of officer negligence at Broad River, and 9 of those resulted in those correctional officers being suspended. During that same period at Lee, there were 21 instances of officer negligence. For those 21 incidents of officer negligence, 16 of those incidents resulted in the officers getting simply oral warnings, and then another officer got a written warning. Only 4 people were suspended for the same kinds of actions.
And is there any indication in the reporting that you guys did and the data you got back that might indicate that this maybe lacks approach to discipline in Lee might have helped facilitate that riot or lead to that riot? Or
Well, I know that we were told by corrections officials that correctional officer discipline is handled by the warden at each facility. And the warden then takes into consideration various things each time, whether the officer's been in trouble before, the seriousness of the offense, that kind of thing. But we were not able to speak to the warden at Lee presently. He's new since the prison riot, and we were referred again to the Department of Corrections spokeswoman for that information. So I don't know that we can make a direct link specifically based on the data. We found one that ended up being our lead, actually, where there was a correctional officer who was in charge of monitoring the West Tower, and at some point the officer sent an alert that there's contraband coming over the walls into the prison, but there was a delay in the alert for some reason. So corrections officials decided to investigate whether the officer had anything to do with the contraband because of the delay in alerting people that it was happening. And ultimately, during the course of that investigation, she admitted that she was pretty much doing nothing, sleeping, eating, talking on her phone.
And like we know in some of these situations, the cell phones were so key to a lot of not only, you know, issues within Lee and this riot alone, but also prisons across the entire state and facilitating legal activity outside of the wire as well.
And there's definitely instances, we found 4 or 5 at least, where corrections officers were fired for bringing cell phones into prisons throughout the state, including 2 women who were twins who were working at Lee. They found $2,345 in their car and a bunch of prepaid cards. and I believe a phone in their car in the parking lot at Lee, and they were both fired after that.
Is there anything in these records, is any comments from these employees that were terminated about what made them do it? I mean, I can obviously make some assumptions about what would make people do this because there's money involved here, but is that predominantly the case, or are they becoming, you know, buddy-buddy with some of these inmates? I know there's even talk about some people affiliated with gangs becoming corrections officers in some situations just to be able to bring in contraband. What was any common themes amongst these corrections officers?
Well, I certainly think in the instances that we saw, there appeared to be a financial aspect to it. Sometimes some of these officers receiving thousands of dollars for what they were doing. There were also instances of correctional officers being charged with sexual misconduct with inmates. And, you know, you just have to wonder what's going on through their minds in those instances. But there's no question what these officers are doing. It's a difficult job. It's a dangerous job. And from what we've seen, the majority of them are doing the job the way they're supposed to be doing it. But we thought it was important to kind of put some attention and to spotlight some of the problems that we found.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly hoping that by spotlighting the gaps that will lead to some type of change, because like Kirk said, the majority of the officers who are there are doing something really difficult, really dangerous, and something that a great many people wouldn't even try to do. So we're hoping that by showing some of the gaps in the system that there will be corrections made.
Mm-hmm. Because yeah, even some of these actions, I mean, it annoys, and I'm sure I guess annoys is probably the best way to say it for some of these other corrections officers who are doing the good job and who are helping and trying to do their best in the difficult situations. But it's also interesting to point out that other outlets have looked into this stuff as well, and they've looked at some of those corrections officers and how their negligence in some cases had led to, I think, $2.5 million costing the state $2.5 million over the past 4 years due to some of their, you know, inadequate responses to situations and negligence in some situations. So,
and we spoke to Director Brian Sterling about that, and he claims and insists that he's trying to do everything he can to hold these officers accountable, that when they do something wrong, they're being punished or fired or even criminally charged. And he's also trying to make an example out of the bad apples, you'd say, to act as a deterrent for the rest of those officers. It's a difficult situation. It's a difficult job. It's a big department.
And even despite these pay raises that we've seen Sterling get from, you know, budget dollars from lawmakers, it doesn't seem like it's helping as much, I guess. It's, I mean, still kind of a low-paying job, especially in a tight labor market. Is that what he was kind of saying in terms of when it comes to recruiting these employees?
Yeah, so one of the things we found as part of our study of the records is that there was what we considered a pretty remarkable turnover of correctional officers, that for two consecutive years for which we had data, 2017 and 2018, more than half of the correctional officers were leaving their jobs by the end of the year, actually 57% each year. So Director Sterling has talked about the corrections officials' efforts to try to fix that, but he says this is a tight labor market, and it's really hard to compete against industries and companies that are offering safer jobs and higher pay. And it's especially difficult to recruit correctional officers in rural prisons, and actually 11 of the state's 21 prisons, excuse me, are in rural areas. So it's even harder there.
Mm-hmm. And I thought it was interesting too, when we were talking about this data, that you were talking about between January 2017 and April 2018, that more than 100 corrections officers were fired, and then 400 were disciplined. I mean, that's a difficult situation there when you look at recruiting and trying to actually retain, these people. Is there anything indicating that it's more than just these individuals acting like this, or is there not enough going on within the Department of Corrections to, I don't know, stymie these activities or this behavior? I mean, it is a difficult situation, no doubt, but was there any indication that maybe these employees aren't getting the guidance that they need to be effective?
I think that's a problem that they're aware of. They've taken a couple steps to try to address that. One, they're doing a new type of testing. It used to be if you passed a drug test and you basically had a reliable car, you got a job as a corrections officer.
And now they've implemented a new test where they ask potential correctional officers, what would you do if you saw a colleague bringing in something that was considered contraband? And do you believe that you can handle difficult situations? And how do you respond in a situation that may require some type of force?
And then they're also trying to do what they call hyper-local recruiting. Instead of just running statewide job advertisements, they're trying to look at the demographics in specific rural communities where they have prisons and advertise in a targeted way to attract those folks. But like Nikki said earlier, when you have options at Volvo or BMW or even tire plants that are paying more or better, and you're not dealing with inmates all day, that's a tough sell.
Mm-hmm. And then just kind of wrapping up here, looking at the talking about that investigation for the Lee Correctional Institution, the riot. Want to get a little bit of update on that, because you did write about that, Nikki, too. The 41 inmates that were investigated, 29 still appear to be under investigation. It's been like 13 months or so like that. There was even video that made it online from inside the prison. You would think that maybe get these investigators in some direction to at least start charging people. Is there any reason why we haven't seen charges brought yet?
So what we know is that shortly after our prison package was published, actually just a few days ago on Friday, the Department of Corrections announced that there's going to be a special team brought in to review the cases connected to the Lee riots to see whether charges will be brought or how charges will be brought and who they'll be brought against, essentially because they want to have somebody who can look at each case deeply and really understand the prison culture, I believe.
And a lot of those inmates have already been shifted around to other facilities.
Sure. So based on the records that we received, we have been able to determine through our analysis that initially 41 inmates were under investigation related to the riot. And 12 of those inmates appear to have been cleared based on the records that we have, which are really recent records, and 29 appear to be still under investigation. And most of those inmates who were present at Lee on the day of the riot and who are under investigation still have been shifted to other maximum security prisons throughout the state.
We made a decision not to identify any of the inmates who are under investigation because they haven't been criminally charged yet. But we were able to look at DOC records and find out some information about who these inmates are. We know that 10 of them have previously been convicted of murder or manslaughter. We know that 6 are serving life sentences, and many of them had been disciplined while serving in prison before for things like having weapons, creating disturbances, threatening to harm prison employees and fellow inmates. And while their ages do range as high as the mid-50s, we also noticed that 17 of these folks are in their 20s.
Mm-hmm. And if it's gang-related, too, I'm guessing it's even more difficult to probably get information about these things. So kind of wrapping it all together, it sounds like, you know, outdated and unsafe facilities, chronic underpaying and understaffing, leading some officers to do misdeeds. I mean, and then you have the cell phones and other contraband kind of fueling all this too. So this still perfect storm that they're trying to contain within Department of Corrections, but hard to do, especially when you're Brian Sterling and you're asking the legislature for $285 million above what you're already getting, and they only give you a couple million additional dollars. You know, to replace doors in prisons or locks on doors. It sounds like a difficult situation that they're just kind of trying to maintain at this point, essentially, is what your reporting shows.
Well, there are a couple of interesting things we learned while we were doing this. One thing I didn't realize is I heard Director Sterling say this, that, you know, you watch movies of prisons and stuff, you push a button and all the doors open or close, and that like 80% of the correctional officers' times are spent opening, locking, and unlocking specific cell doors. That's what they do all day. And then something else I think we wanted to point out, not all these officers who got in trouble and were fired for really serious offenses. I mean, there are numerous instances of officers being fired and disciplined for sleeping on the job. And there was also a guy that stuck out in my mind. He got off work and he went to the local convenience store to buy some beer. And he was wearing his rumpled prison uniform and some pink flip-flops. They're not allowed to buy beer wearing a prison uniform, so he lost his job over that.
Wow.
So, I mean, some of these things were very serious, mm-hmm. and definitely caught your attention. And some of these folks just use some poor judgment, and we're seeing it in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Just looking at what the legislature needs to do. And you know, additional funding, money doesn't fix everything, but I'm sure it would help these situations.
Was you're probably aware there's a House Oversight Committee looking at the Department of Corrections right now. It's possible that they'll look into some of the things that we've been reporting about. But I know the department's getting a real close look from them. But I think it's tough for the department to try to get money from the General Assembly. There's a lot of competing needs. And I'm not sure taxpayers are always really excited about the prospect of putting more money in the
prisons. Looking forward to any more projects we can foresee, any more reports from information on this, or...
Well, we're still taking a look at the data. We're trying to see what else it might tell us. So we expect that there'll be some additional reporting down the road.
You can find the reporting from Nikki Mayo and Kirk Brown and other reporters at greenvilleonline.com. Thank you all for reporting on this, and we'll keep an eye out for those future reports.
Thanks for coming up and talking with us.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020-related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. Starting off, McClatchy, D.C. reports that the U.S. House voted late last Monday, 354-58, to approve a $19.1 billion disaster relief bill for states affected by recent natural disasters. Out of that pot of money, South Carolinians will qualify for cash from federal grant programs to assist in local recovery efforts still ongoing after Hurricanes Florence and Michael last fall. Now, three South Carolina Republicans, Jeff Duncan, William Timmons, and Ralph Norman, voted against the measure, which President Donald Trump signed on Thursday. The Spartanburg Herald Journal reports that horse farmer Michael LaPierre has become the first Republican to challenge Senator Lindsey Graham for his seat in 2020. At the South Carolina Christian Chamber of Commerce luncheon in Spartanburg, LaPierre said that God told him to enter the race to give voters an alternative to Graham. And on the 2020 front, former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke will be campaigning in the state this weekend, and on Saturday he'll participate in the Black Economic Alliance Presidential Forum with Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senators Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren. You can get free tickets to the event at the Charleston Music Hall through blackeconomicalliance.org. The forum will be televised exclusively on BET Networks on June 16th at 10 a.m. In our final section, did you know, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. And did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with us with some more great trivia? He is. Russ, hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Glad to be here.
What do we got?
Well, we're still in the beginning of summer mode, you know, thinking about vacations and school getting out and things like that. A lot of people be going to visit South Carolina's state parks.
Oh, yeah.
Our state park system is one of the crown jewels of the state. There are 47 state parks.
Wow.
From the mountains to the sea, you name it, all varieties of different
kings and queens.
Exactly. The newest, Musgrove Mill State Park near Clinton in Lawrence County on the Ennery River, opened in 2003. So if you're a Revolutionary War buff and you've not been to Musgrove Mill State Park, that's a must stop. But our question is, what was the first state park in South Carolina? What was the first of those 47?
Okay.
A, Oconee State Park, obviously in Oconee County.
Mm.
Table Rock State Park, that's in northern Pickens County. Sesquicentennial State Park, which is just outside of Columbia on the way to Camden in the Sand Hills region of the state. And D, Myrtle Beach State Park. Obviously everyone knows where Myrtle Beach State Park is. Oconee, Table Rock, Sesquicentennial, Myrtle Beach.
This is just a stab in the dark at this point. I'm sure people are screaming at their radios right now or their phones. I'm going to go maybe just Table Rock just because.
All four of those were in the initial group of 16 state parks. which were built in the 1930s by the Civilian Conservation Corps. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're familiar with that. That was part of the New Deal coming out of the Depression, people mm-hmm. looking to put people to work to get the country back on its feet. And then in the late 1930s, it veered into like national defense type projects. But a number of things, like the Santee Cooper Project, was a Civilian Conservation Corps. So the first group of state parks, 16 of them, were all came in that way. But the first state park that opened in 1936 was Myrtle Beach State Park.
Huh. Oh, brother, this guy stinks!
Still considered by many to be the crown jewel of the state parks, primarily because it has a 1 mile of beautiful beach there on the Grand Strand.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, going down to Myrtle Beach, move over Ocean Boulevard. Well, thanks, Russ.
My pleasure.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag, that is. Send us a message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Greenville News. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. Sean Scott is our intern, and a big shout out to him for producing On Location this week. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on June 7th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. The summer solstice approaches.